for KFAI comes from the Parkway Theater and Lounge, presenting The Honey Dogs, Friday, December 19th. Minnesota rockers, The Honey Dogs, take the Parkway stage with their latest release, Algebra for Broken Hearts. It's their first new album in 9 years, and their first in 28 years with the original Honey Dogs lineup. Opening the show is 6 Mile Grove. More information on The Honey Dogs is available at theparkwaytheater.com.
Support for KFAI comes from First Avenue, presenting Trailer Trash's Trashy Little Christmas, Friday and Saturday, December 19th and 20th. Trailer Trash brings their Trashy Little Christmas show, Reindeer Games, to the Turf Club for some holiday fun. They have a brand new song to share, inspired by Rudolph's struggles of being left out in the cold by the other reindeer. More information about Trailer Trash's Trashy Little Christmas Show at the Turf Club can be found at first-avenue.com.
Support for KFAI comes from the Cedar Cultural Center, presenting Festive Beats of Africa, Saturday, December 20th.
Festive Beats of Africa is a 120-minute celebration of Africa's rhythms, unity, and culture through music, dance, and storytelling.
The show features Carolyn Naomi performing Afrobeat and holiday fusion songs. Diatoti delivers Congolese music, and Africa Depo, dance team that blends African and contemporary styles.
More information about the Festive Beats of Africa can be found at thetheater.org.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
Bonjour, hello. Welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Leah Lem. Today, we're revisiting a conversation from December of 2024. In this episode, we chat with human rights advocate, singer, and storyteller Joaquin Lapointe. Joaquin is Sichangu Lakota citizen of the Rosebud Sioux tribe. He focuses his studies on Indigenous rights, human rights, and youth organizing. So please enjoy our time with Joaquin, where we hear about his work and his upbringing, which was foundational to his understanding of self and the world.
There's a lot of teachings with this drum, a lot of teachings that my mother and father were able to continue to pass on to me, and stories about, you know, my Lakota elders and heroes and legends, you know, long ago that inspired me about how they would take care of each other. And some of the traditions that really stood tall in my mind as a kid growing up continue to stand tall.
Bonjour, hello. Welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Leah Lem.
And I'm your other host, Cole Primo. Miigwech for joining us on Native Lights. Native Lights is more than a podcast and radio show. At its core, it's a place for Native folks to tell their stories. Each and every week, we have captivating conversations with great guests from a whole lot of different backgrounds. We're talking musicians, artists, community leaders, doctors, healthcare advocates, you name it. There's just this wonderful mixture of passions that we get to explore on a weekly basis. And we talk to our guests about their gifts and how they share those gifts with their community. And it all centers around the big point of purpose in our lives and amplifying Native voices. So how you doing, Leah?
I'm doing well. I'm doing well. How about you?
Doing great. It's that time of the year where I should really be thinking about getting presents for the family, and feeling slight anxiety about that. Other than that, I mean, I feel like every year I always overthink what to get everybody. I don't know about you. But it's just something that happens.
You know, there are some great Indigenous art markets out there that are popping up around the state that I like to visit.
There you go. There you go.
That's always a good option. So, yeah, that is that time of year, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking about all of those New Year's resolutions that I need to finish before the end of this year. So I have to scramble and finish the rest of J.R.R. Tolkien's The Silmarillion, which of course reads like, I don't know, a textbook. So I got to finish that. I'm doing all right, but that was my major resolution that I need to get done. So wish me luck.
I tried I read like a paragraph and then I have to go back and read it again, like over and over again.
I think I just got to give up on trying to understand everything that comes across my eyeballs.
Yeah.
I can't comprehend everything because Tolkien just introduces new things or different words for the same thing, just without reference or context. So you just kind of have to sit back and just let it roll over your brain folds and wish for the best.
I'll have to order the Silmarillion for dummies or something. I don't know.
Cool. Well, you know, as we wind down here, as the days are reaching their darkest, I am very thankful for Native Lights because, hey, it brings a source of light into my life.
There you go.
Every week. I'm really excited to talk to our guest today, Wakian LaPointe. You might know him. Wakian is a Sechungu Lakota citizen from the Rosebud Sioux tribe. He graduated from the U of M with a BA in political science and a minor in American Indian Studies, and he has his master's. And now he's a PhD student in American Studies at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. So much commitment there. I'm very impressed. And Wakian's also a Lakota singer and storyteller. A really great balance of talents and all of that good stuff. So welcome, Wakian LaPointe.
Great to be here.
All right, Buju, could you just start out by introducing yourself and telling us where you're joining us from and all that good stuff?
Minneapolis, Wana, St. Paul, Elmanke, Naha. My name is Wakian LaPointe. I'm Sechungu Hu Lakota. I'm here in St. Paul and moved here just recently and been in the Twin Cities American Indian community for a number of years now. I'm also a student at the University of Minnesota and as well as a consultant for Native nonprofits. And I think that's about all of it. Yep.
All right. How are you doing today? How's the family?
Oh, yeah. The family's doing good. Wahi's doing good at home. Got my father, my mother doing very well and doing a lot of work in community and across the Midwest here. And my brother Thorne keeping busy, and my sister Chana as well, keeping very busy. And so all doing amazing work.
Yeah, it seems like you all are doing really cool things in community. So it's really exciting to see when you're all together too. Or, you know, you and your brother or you and your parents. It's really cool to see how you work as a family. So I'm hoping to ask you about that in a bit. But before we get to that, is there anything you are thinking about these days?
I think I got a lot of things I'm focusing on. Well, I'll try not to do too much. I'm focusing around human rights strategy, what my future work will look like in that area. Also just focusing around being a student, but a PhD student at the University of Minnesota. And, you know, figuring my way out in terms of what am I going to be doing more of once I get through this sort of final leg of doctoral studies. And then I'm involved in a number of community initiatives here in Twin Cities and have a role also as in philanthropy and trying to figure out if there's a culmination or if there's simply a next leg in the journey, what that's going to look like.
Mm-hmm. How do you go about kind of strategizing your next steps?
I think about a sense of purpose for myself moving forward, you know, feeling a sense of purpose in the work I'm doing and looking back at my values of wanting to contribute to communities or Native communities and work with Native youth as I did early on, you know, beginning from the age of 15. And I'm 34 years old now, so I didn't think I'd make it here so fast. I felt like I was just my early 20s, not too long ago. Now I'm in early 30s and, you know, getting to my mid 30s. Almost feel like, you know, teeing up what I've gathered so far and tying it up and making sure I got it sort of prepared in a way where I'm moving forward in a consolidated manner. And, you know, how can I make sense of what I'm doing so far?
All right. So you mentioned you're a PhD student. So I'm just curious, like, what's that like? How far along are you in that journey? And what are your research interests?
A lot of it lands around human rights, Indigenous people's human rights, specifically in support of Indigenous youth from diverse countries. You know, how can we strategize some of these simple, pragmatic things in ways that can then leverage our voice, especially as, you know, global environmental issues continue to escalate and, you know, we find ourselves in a future 20, 30, 50 years from now where Indigenous rights represent a solution more and more, but really have a central place in representing a sustainable future. So, you know, generally my research would kind of focus around that, around interviews with other Indigenous youth. You know, how do Indigenous youth organize sort of UN mechanisms or instruments to advance their causes or elevate or amplify their own voices? Just happen to have a number of scholars here in Minnesota that are researching the area and have written about concepts like Ocheti Shakuni internationalism, the global Indigenous rights movement, and development of, you know, human rights or standard setting for Indigenous people. So different things. And I think I'm benefiting from, you know, the opportunity to have those types of professors there while I'm there in my PhD at the U of M.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and AMPRS with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're revisiting our conversation with Joaquin LaPointe, a Sechango Lakota citizen from the Rosebud Sioux Tribe, a human rights advocate, singer, and storyteller.
You mentioned environmental issues. Are there issues that you find Indigenous people around Minnesota face that Indigenous people on the other side of the globe might face as well?
Yeah, we've been holding a series of Miniki Wakan summits since about 2017. We first announced this summit at the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues in 2016. And just recently, we held a summit this year at the McNamara Center, University of Minnesota, and partnered with a number of UMN departments. We had different Indigenous water scholars, researchers, water resource departments from tribal nations, and other types of water organizations and nonprofits who were there to sort of share in a conversation with one another, learn about how each other was addressing water issues and about, you know, what types of strategies are they employing to make sure that water protection and even restoration is part of the community and community youth experience. So often I think that what rises in these conversations is that Indigenous youth are also playing a central role in protection and trying to identify different innovations to protect and restore their waters. What we're learning is that there's shared water issues in different areas, but also just as much solutions that Indigenous peoples and youth are spearheading in different areas that really represent a big opportunity for different Indigenous territories. You know, in Nishota Makoche, there's, you know, a number of rivers that hold deep cultural significance for diverse tribal nations and a number of different strategies that contribute to the overall well-being of water, and that could be deepening cultural connections between youth and their sacred riverways. And that in itself is a huge approach. And we had some Maori presenters last year talk about how community relationship to rivers is also a strong indicator and measure of water protection and restoration. So part of restoring water doesn't just base itself on Western perceptions of what restoration looks like, but instead also restores the Indigenous connection to those waterways. And then you have a number of development projects here in an urban area reclaiming Dakota waterways that we're seeing, and they're doing amazing work, these Dakota organizations. But it's also a model for Indigenous water governance or co-governance, where community has a voice and, you know, strengthening those relationships. And so that whole initiative there is also a model for Indigenous peoples to learn from. So one of the things that amazes me is the Indigenous youth that might be like individual Indigenous youth leaders going about their own initiative or programming around water and raising their own funds for it and sometimes not getting the support they need. And yet here they are doing a huge project, collecting data on how their waterways are doing and presenting recommendations to leadership. Yet they're not, you know, a tribal water resource department, but they're putting their best effort forward to carry out initiative that, you know, should have occurred long ago, but now they're carrying out and bringing other Indigenous youth with them to train them in sort of water research and testing, but also how can they reconnect to, let's say, us like Lakota youth to water, and how are issues like mining and other types of issues impacting or will impact rivers and lakes and drinking water sources for tribal communities.
We always like to ask, where did you find this passion? How did it come about? Like, do you remember the first spark and what led you down this path?
You know, my father and my mother always told stories to us growing up, and we grew up in a number of different places, about Washington, Oakland, California, a little bit here and there on a Rosebud Reservation, and got to know our relatives during those times. And then ultimately here in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where, you know, there's a big and vibrant Native community, and learn just how much this community, Indigenous youth, were supported to carry on a number of traditions like storytelling, singing. And there are a number of elders too here when we first moved here, and I was probably around 10 or 13. And, you know, there's some Lakota elders here, and our father encouraged us to present one of the elders with traditional tobacco. And so we did that. And, you know, he took his time to teach us songs, and, you know, he was very kind and compassionate and would take us places to storytell with him. And also, you know, he just sang for our birthdays. And so that was the first time I think someone sang for me a Lakota song for my birthday. I think I was maybe around 13, but I was really moved even at that age, to, you know, just by that action alone, to have these Lakota elders singing for me as a kid. And so I think that feeling or inspiration and purpose and belief that this drum gave me and my brother and family, ultimately an extended family, was something that, you know, really kind of echoed back to me or called on me to like continue to help others, and helped me to learn how to use my own voice, I would say, to not just sing, but also to speak up for things that Native communities and Native youth where it was important to, and where oftentimes were excluded from. There's a lot of teachings with this drum, a lot of teachings that my mother and father were able to continue to pass on to me, and stories about, you know, my Lakota elders and heroes, and even so far as legends, you know, long ago that inspired me about how they would take care of each other, and some of the traditions that really stood tall in my mind as a kid growing up, continue to stand tall. And so they really took their time to do that with us, offer sort of prayers or mochekie, like traditional Lakota prayers as a family at Tuahe. And Tuahe means family, but it's also, you know, a foundational unit of our nations as Ocheti Shakumi. And so, and I really focus on those types of teachings because there's a lot of sort of ways of thinking and ways of doing that the Lakota language and stories really invoke in my everyday actions and continue to guide me even as I'm in a PhD program and constantly thinking about, you know, this is a huge campus, University of Minnesota. I'm getting a lot of, so much work to do in here, but, you know, I could always find myself singing a tune and really thinking back to the simple values. If I start to get, you know, too far into the weeds of academia. And so I will try to remember a story, but every time I tell a story, I always ends up going very long. And just because, like, we've told it like many times now, we've been asked to storytell since we were little kids, and actually went after storytelling opportunities. And so anytime a community was holding storytelling, one of our mentors would go and sign us up right away, and then we'd go to that community and storytell in Minnesota and elsewhere. Yeah, stories continue to inspire me, and I like the sense of purpose and direction that Lakota stories give me, even stories about the four directions. And one of the things that that relates back to is, like, without these directional brothers and spirits, you know, I myself would not have a strong direction in life. Stories give strong direction and a strong sense of vision of where we're going and looking in our own lives. So really appreciate my people's ways.
Yeah, it's really good to have those foundational values and belief structures to remind us of what's important, what's providing that direction, because so often we can get whisked up in academia or whatever the work might be, that it's always good to have that guide there to remind yourself of where you want to go. And so when that happens, how do you recognize it? What signals to you that you need to kind of reset and get back on the path with your values?
When I'm super busy, and I am super busy, and I've been learning to like admit that more, because, you know, I think being a singer or being a helper and being asked to like help in different places, you know, one of the things I was taught by singers was to always help out when someone asks. In a Western system, that can turn into a really exploitative sort of practice upon a singer. And, you know, I think the Western system capitalizes on people's time and trying to exhaust it as much as possible. And that could be very harmful to values like Lakota singer, who's taught to help out community. It's always, for me, about making sure I'm differentiating between my cultural practices and appropriate spaces, and understanding that maybe in academic or different spaces, you know, the arc, the narrative is still heavily bends towards exploitation of time, exploitation of life. And in terms of, you have to meet all of these expectations in order to achieve something. And it's very individualized. And so in those types of spaces, not just like academia, but just in life in general, I think I have to figure out what are some of the things that often might try to knock me off my path. And I think that, you know, one of them is the mentalities that come with academia. Like, I myself ain't doing this work alone, I would say. And that, you know, family is something of a compass that helps me to return back to the path that I find the most meaning in. I think sometimes, though, you know, it's really hard. You know, sometimes you get burnt out. We see a lot about burnout culture now being raised. And one of the things that comes in actualization for me is understanding that there's Native people, and Native people are often in high demand. And so how do we manage and offer our time while still making sure that our own self-care is equally important as we plan our days out? And so I'm starting to do that more, because I was getting tired there pretty much, and doing a couple things a day, main jobs in terms of consultant work and working my roles in different areas. I literally had to like think about, how can I get more energy for the day? And so I just go to the gym and try to keep that up as long as I could. I'll be well in my 40s here pretty soon, so trying to make sure I'm actually going into my 40s with some good habits that build energy in me, while knowing that systems like academia can, you know, really take a lot of energy. And yeah, different little techniques like that have helped me. And I would say it's more about like mental health techniques that are coming into play when I choose to make sure that I am being very direct and honest about what I can and cannot do. And that was really hard as a young singer, because I was doing a lot of things, and people would often say, oh, you guys are, you know, everywhere, all these events. And because we were being asked to sing and share some things, and, you know, really appreciate that growing up. But as I get older now, my energy is getting more, you know, I got to be more selective with my energy, because it's not infinite. Yeah.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers, with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're revisiting our conversation with Joaquin Lapointe, a Sechango Lakota citizen from the Rosebud Sioux Tribe, a human rights advocate, singer, and storyteller.
On the show, we're very much advocates for treating oneself at times and like balancing work life. What other things do you do to like help that situation?
Now you're getting into my little toolkit. One of the things I do is just kind of meditation. By that, I mean, you're in your workday, you're in your busyness, and then you don't really get the time to see how fast of a pace you're going. And then by noon, if you didn't notice by then, and your pace and how fast you're working is too much, and it actually starts to bring too much stress, starts to trigger maybe de-stressors. And so one of the things that it makes sense to me is to make sure I'm meditating first thing in the morning and narrating my day in the way that I want to. And so I always say, today's a beautiful day, look outside, the weather's nice. And, you know, I feel like I start singing a song there. But if I have something I'm looking forward to in a day, I'm saying, oh, I'm looking forward to that. And I start telling my mind and my body these narratives that, you know, the subconscious begins to tell the brain itself how to then respond to that type of stimuli and the type of narrative you're feeding yourself. Oftentimes, the negative storylines are fed through, you know, social media and external factors. And so how do we feed our own minds first in the morning to make sure that we're getting off to a great start? And then at noon, making sure I'm resetting or regrounding in those narratives, because in between that 9 and 12 point, something really took off and made me work fast, maybe harder, and I forgot to meditate, then it could be detrimental later on in that day. I reset, reground at noon. Oftentimes I'll go outside, I'll just take some deep breaths, and then also understanding that I might be breathing fast because of the amount of work that we're asked to do in these days. Then at 3 o'clock, I'll do it. 6 o'clock, I'll do it again if I need to, you know, before bed so I can sleep all the way through the night. Yeah, a number of techniques, I guess, throughout the day to help me with that. And yeah, storytelling and meditation are one of the ways, I guess, I reclaim my time, but also making sure that my energy is at the pace and momentum that I want it to be at.
Yeah, I like that a lot. Thanks for sharing, because I feel like once I hit that stress point, I'm too late. It almost is too big of a job then to reset. So if you kind of stay on top of it, you can prevent the burnout, or, you know, mini burnout from happening in that day-to-day sense. As we wind down our conversation here, Joaquin, you do a lot of work with your family. You know, Cole and I are siblings. We get to do a little work together ourselves, and it's a great way to connect with each other, even though we're, what, 180 miles apart. What's it like to work with your family so much?
It's been interesting. I've been thinking about the ways that my parents have sort of deliberately sort of put in how they decided to transfer their knowledge and know-how they built throughout their life. I see that as wealth transference as well, in that my dad, my mom have built these knowledge bases and skill sets and wisdom throughout their life, and then have taken the time to then give us experiences and even to facilitate certain community experiences to then put what they taught us into practice within our family. So they literally had this way of doing things for us as kids growing up into young adults, and now as adults, that knowledge has literally just become part of me and how I think and what I do. You know, there's collective processes of coming together as community, but there's also ways to think about how imagination, creativity were sort of stymied by colonialism and these barriers that still exist today to individualize community experiences. So the goal is always to think about what is the process that is gonna make the most difference for our communities, but also enable our communities to fully express their collective creativity and so on. So I'm always thinking about that perspective, and it's been helpful to continue to work with my dad and mom and help them on their initiatives. And I find that now, as I'm older, I gained a number of skill sets, like in technology, but also in nonprofits. And so now I find myself like, how can I contribute to my mom's work? How can I contribute to my dad's work? So I find like there's a giving back phase we're in right now. It's the same thing with my brother and sister, is that they're able to give back to my mom and dad, but also, you know, continue to have that reciprocal relationship and help each other. And no joke, it's like a advisory team.
Right. Well, key on the point. What a great individual.
Just hearing, you know, his experience with Native youth and the fuel that it gives him to keep going.
I really appreciate when Joaquin was talking about how Indigenous people are solutions oriented. That just like pulls me right back into, you know what, we got this. It helps me stay out of the realm of despair.